Dear friends, you're listening to Slappy Pinch Bottom's Odd Preoccupation here on KOOP Austin, and I'm very pleased to have with me some folks from the rapidly approaching Maker Faire, which is going to be on October 20th and 21st out at the Travis County Expo Center. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
And would you like to introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm Dale Doherty. I'm an organizer of Maker Faire and the editor and publisher of Make Magazine and Craft Magazine.
Great. And I'm Sherry Huss, and I'm the director of Maker Faire, so I do everything around Maker Faire.
Yep. And I'm Vern Grainer. I'm the current president of the Robot Group in Austin.
And you're one of the featured makers that's going to be out there at the Maker Faire this year.
I think we are responsible for that, yes.
And so that's sort of what the fair is all about, is bringing together makers or people who create projects that they are also willing to share the instructions for making with other people. That's kind of the underlying philosophy of Make Magazine, isn't it?
The magazine has two aspects to it. I call it my oscillation factor. Mm-hmm. I'm looking through the magazine, and I get really inspired. I look at an article, and I read about how someone did something. I go, that's so elegant. Yeah. That's so amazing. And it gets very inspired. Then I'll read another article where someone does something amazing. I'm like, God, I suck. I'm never going to be able to do something that cool. You know. And I go back and forth between the two of them based on, you know, which article I'm reading.
Yeah.
But inevitably, it pulls me back to the, you know, well, this is inspiring. It means that somebody can do this. I can do this.
Yeah.
So what is Austin's Robot Group going to be bringing out to the Maker Faire here this year?
Oh, boy. Let's see. Run down the list. We're going to have a local Austin artist that's been with the group, actually one of the founding members of the Robot Group, which is Brooks Coleman. And he was going to be bringing out a number of his sculptures. There's some of them are animatronic. Some of them are a little more static displays. For example, one of the ones he's going to have is a statue that he created that's called Glamour Girl. And that's made from rebar and I think bent aluminum wire, and it's run all through with electroluminescent wire pieces, and he has a manual sequencing device that causes all these lights to turn on and off throughout the entire body of the sculpture. It's really fascinating to watch. I think some of the other stuff that we'll be bringing out that's Brooks is going to
And where is Glamour Girl right now?
Glamour Girl's in my entry hall right now.
I'm lucky, where we saw it.
I'm lucky enough to have a private collection of Brooks's artifacts currently residing in the entry hall of my house, which I will be sad when they go. I'm sure that they'll end up moving to a museum someplace and be worth billions. But for right now, they're in my living room as people walk through the house. He's got some amazing work. He's one of the artists we have. We also, we're going to have a number of items that have been group projects. One of the items is the Robo Spin Art Machine, which these guys have had a chance to play with. We're looking forward to having a lot of people play with that. The Robo Spin Art Machine was an experiment in trying to interface what I refer to as the joystick generation, which are kids, like I have an 11-year-old son, and his interface to life is pretty much digital. Everything he touches has got buttons on it, and it's got switches, and it has stereo soundtrack and limited ammunition. And you know, the whole idea was that I had shown him a spin art. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these things. It's where you have a piece of paper that's down in a bucket with a motor that turns it, and when paint strikes it, it then flies off to the edges and makes these very cool, you know, psychedelic looking patterns. And I found one of these things that I'd made in the 70s, and I showed it to him. You know, I guess he was 9 and a half, 10 years old, and I was like, check this out, it's so cool. And he was just totally not impressed with this. He was just like, yeah, okay, so there's some paint on a paper, whatever. It kind of chewed on me for a while. I was like, why didn't this have the appeal that it had to me when I was that age? And what it boiled down to is that he didn't really understand the interface. So I thought, well, what if I can make something that would, you know, bridge the gap between where he is and where this artwork was? So we created this thing called the Robo Spin Art Machine. It's got a digital interface on the front panel with a joystick and a series of buttons. You have a limited amount of ammunition of paint. Every time you press a button on the front, one drop of paint is released down into the pit. And then there's an arm that is traversing over the top of the pit that you control with a joystick that allows you to aim. And then every time you hit one of the buttons, it fires paint down onto the card. So you have, and every time you hit it, it also plays stereo sound effects, and it plays a rock and roll background behind the whole thing while it's playing. So they got limited time, limited ammo, rock and roll soundtrack and sound effects, and they're using it to create analog artworks. And every single artwork is going to be different because it depends on where the paint lands on the page. I'm trying to think what else.
Oh, and everyone gets to walk away with something.
Yeah, everybody gets to take the painting with them when
they
leave.
Can take.
So it's very cool.
Yep.
I'm trying to think of some of the other ones. I don't want to. I'm trying to go around.
Marvin.
There. Marvin. Oh, the Screaming Baby Heads. Absolutely, Screaming Baby Heads.
Everyone loves the Screaming Baby Heads.
Yeah, Marvin has a series called Biomechanicals. It's a whole world that he's created, and he's created a whole bunch of different both static and animated art pieces to support the storyline of the Biomechanicals. And he has the Screaming Baby Head Band and. He supposedly found these things that were living in the back of his house, and he dug one of them up, and it was part machine and part biomaterial.
I see.
He's got a whole comic book series written that shows how it was created and where they were found and what caused them to occur, and then there's good ones and bad ones, and it's an amazing fantasy world.
You suspect that he built them himself, but there's no way to be sure.
There's no way to be sure, as a matter of fact. That is absolutely true. Professor Conrad is quite amazing in that regard.
That's great. Well, and let me ask real quick, too, if there's someone in our listening audience who is really intrigued by robots, would like to get into building robots themselves, can they come to a robot group meeting? How do they do that?
We meet every Thursday, and it's if you go to the website robotgroup.org, you can see the meeting location is being announced there. Like, if you go to our webpage, you can find out where we're going to be meeting on that Thursday night. Most of the time, it's going to be
robotgroup.com?
Robotgroup.org.
We're
a nonprofit. We're a 501c nonprofit org. But the location is usually fairly south. Our current location right now that we've been meeting fairly regularly is we've been meeting at the Heritage, which is an assisted living center. It's basically a retirement home. And there are a lot of folks there that are retired engineers, teachers, mm-hmm. this sort of thing. And so we think it's really kind of an interesting way to merge together people that maybe are kind of marginalized by their physical condition or stuff. They can actually show up at these meetings also and, kind of observe the spectacle. And it also lets us have a chance to talk to some people that have an incredible amount of experience. So that's one of the reasons we're meeting there.
We've been talking about the Maker Fair, which is coming to Travis County Expo Center here October 20th and 21st, starting at 10 a.m. each day, you said?
That's correct. Don't forget, we have makezine.com and craftzine.com. So we have multiple, depending on where you want to get your infusion of ideas and input. And also, don't forget, since Austin's a big music town, we have all the musical instrument makers that span from everything from very creative percussive toys that are made out of reclaimed bottle caps and whatnot to some more interesting electronic guitars and
musical Tesla coils.
Absolutely. Which and we have true. The theremins.
The therapings.
And what is a theraping?
What is a theraping? The theraping was actually one of the crossover projects between First Night, because the First Night funded the theraping development the first time around. It was kind of an interesting story because one of the members of our group, Denise Scioli, had put in a proposal to First Night for something called the Robot Marching Theremin Band. And she did this without really understanding how a theremin itself worked and not realizing that in order to play a theremin well, you have to have extraordinarily good body control, because a theremin is dependent upon your position to the instrument. As your hands move closer or further away, the pitch changes. And playing a theremin well is a lot like, almost like a ballet or a dance. You have to be very, very precise in your movements. So if you can't play a theremin well, it's more like trying to play a violin badly, because there's no fret stops so that the notes can go sharp and flat, and if you breathe hard, it'll go sharp and flat.
And just for our listeners who may not have seen a theremin in action, it's a musical instrument that is played simply by waving your hands in the air sort of between these two kind of electrical pickup nodes. You can tell a little bit more about that, but that's the essence of it. You're not touching anything.
Right. It was one of the very first instruments ever created that was played without being touched at all. You actually just waved your arms around to make it play. Surprisingly enough, this is kind of an offspring from the, originally it was part of the experimentation to find out proximity fuses for bombs in the 1920s. And so they were trying to figure out how can they make something blow up when it gets near to something, and they couldn't tell how the frequency was working until they put a speaker on it. They're like, hey, this is kind of cool. It makes these neat sounds. So anyhow, the idea was that Denise put in this proposition to them and said, let's do a robot theremin marching band. And they said, hey, that's great. And they funded it. And she came to me and she says, now all we need to do is build a bunch of theremins and everybody will march with these theremins. And I said, have you ever heard a theremin play? And she goes, oh, it sounds beautiful. I said, yeah, if it's played right, And I said, but if you had a bunch of people that don't know what they're doing and they're marching with these things bouncing around, it's going to sound like someone trying to murder a bag of cats with a mallet. I mean, it's going to sound horrific. We're going to drive people away.
If you've never done that, it is a terrible sound.
It's a terrible sound. So I said, well, okay, being a technology guy and being the robot group, we're like every solution looks like technology to us. So I said, okay, well, what are the problems when you're doing this? Well, first off, you can play the wrong note. So I thought, well, how do we solve that? Well, we got a computer system to pick the notes for us. So it actually takes just a blues scale, and it picks out only the notes out of the scale that play right with each other. The second thing that can go wrong is you play the note at the wrong time. So we hooked all these little tiny computers together. They're actually called basic stamps. And we plugged them all into a central clock. And that clock then sends the pulses to them so they all play at the same time. So we can't play a wrong note, and we can't play at the wrong time. And that way we've solved the problem of playing music together. The next thing we had to do is make it like a theremin. So we used a sonar sensor on the top of the unit, and you just wave your hand over the sonar sensor. It senses the distance your hand is from the instrument and plays pitches that are sharper or lower depending upon how close your hand is to the instrument.
But it's not continuously variable in pitch like an actual theremin.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so what you get, and so because it was that way and we had it to where you were only playing, you know, everybody was playing locked step with quarter notes, and it was kind of boring. So we're like, okay, what can we do to make it different? We gave some buttons up on the instrument that you can press that let it play eighth note, quarter note, or 16th note. So you can make it play faster and slower as you're moving your hand around. And the central clock in the middle that drove all the instruments, we hooked that up to a drum machine and a bass guitar line and programmed it to start playing a bass riff and a drum riff behind it. So we would present a palette of music that was similar to what most of the audience would expect to hear. We wanted to make it so it wasn't quite so avant-garde that we would have people go, well, you know, I don't understand what this is. We had it in 4/4 time with a bass line and a drum line and people playing these musical instruments. And one of the neat things about it is because we were in the parade, we were moving. And so because it's somewhat repetitive, we are only exposing the audience for, you know, 30 seconds or a minute to it. So it's fresh for the audience that goes by. For us, it's a little bit tedious. And it is. It's machine music, and it doesn't require any talent on the part of the user to play that. And those instruments
but still it delivers a sense that when you do something happens.
Well, what's really fun to see is we've taken it to the Children's Museum and we had it at Maker Faire out in San Mateo, and to see kids play with these things, it's just amazing. You give this kid this guitar-shaped instrument, and they're very fancifully shaped instruments. Some are shaped like rocket ships. Some are shaped like robots with big antennas or aliens. And we put them on like a guitar and let the kids play with these things, and they become an instant rock star. I mean, you know, they're you know, dancing around and jumping up and down, and because they can't do anything wrong. You can't play it wrong. There isn't a way to do it.
That was a fantastic description, and I really like that too, just as an example of the kind of process that a maker might go through when they're developing a project. You know, you have some ideas, you cobble something together and it works, but it doesn't quite work the way you want it to. So you add some new elements and it kind of works, but not quite. You can work a little better. So you keep on modifying the original design. I really think that after the end time comes, the people who have been subscribing to Making Craft magazines are going to have such an edge over the rest of the people.
Right. Well, I think one thing too is what Vern just went through was the passion. So you could feel that in Vern describing it, and that runs across regardless of whatever a maker is making. There's a deep passion and a desire to communicate that and share it with someone else that really is interested, and that's what Maker Faire is all about. The whole fairgrounds is going to just be filled with people that are incredibly passionate, and that's an amazing thing. And then I don't know if we have time for, we have a very special, another thing that Vern's very passionate about.
Oh, yes, we can't neglect
our fourth
that.
Guest here this evening.
Yeah, please tell us about the peanut butter monster detector.
Peanut butter monster detector, another device kind of born out of necessity when I'm a dad and I've got my daughter who's now 5 years old, and like many kids, she would sometimes in the night become afraid because she'd hear the air conditioner shut off or something would go bang or the room would settle and it would wake her up. And if she would wake up, she would then come down into our bed and crawl into bed with us. And 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, she's crawled into bed and I'm like, honey, what's wrong? She's like, there's a monster in my room. Okay, so I pick her up and I carry her back up the stairs and I turn the light on and I show her there's no monster. I open the closet. And this becomes a fairly routine thing whenever the air conditioner makes noise or the dog barks or whatever. So I was like, well, how can I find a way to do this? Again, technology is what I use to solve most problems. So I thought, okay, what have we got a lot of around here? Well, we've got a lot of peanut butter jars. So there's a good chassis of some kind that I could use as a way to hold this thing. But what I wanted to do is come up with something a little more active, as an active reassurance, so that if she became scared, she could take some act on her own that would help reassure her and help her go back to sleep without having to drag me out of bed and up a flight of stairs. So I created something called the Peanut Butter Monster Detector. That's what we have sitting on the chair over there. It's sitting a fourth guest over there with its own microphone. It's a peanut butter jar that has a large red button on the top. There's a very dim red light. And we can place this on the nightstand. And what it does is when she gets scared, we've told her if you get scared at night or if you hear something and you think there might be monsters, you press the button on the top of this unit. Now, when they do that, there's a small microprocessor inside of it, and it immediately lights up some very bright white LED lights that light up the whole room very brightly. So that helps reduce the anxiety right there, is having bright light on in the room, because shadows and such are scary. So the room gets very bright. And the next thing it does is it starts immediately making noise, and it makes this kind of a high-tech beeping and booping sound. And it announces the fact that it says, monster scan is activated. And it starts to move a servo motor inside that has a head on the top of it that has some LEDs. And inside, of course, we have a piece of unobtainium, which is used to detect monsters. And that is used to scan the room.
Rare element.
Very rare element, very difficult to obtain. The scan head moves back and forth and it scans the room and it makes these noises. And then when it gets done, it says, I've scanned the room and there's no monsters. And then just to be safe, it scans again. So it scans twice. When it gets done, it then comes on and says, goes back, you see the red and green lights blinking back and forth like it's trying to make a decision. And then it lights up with a green light and it says, no monsters detected, go back to sleep. Go back to sleep. And so it gives her an instruction. Hey, don't worry about it. All clear. Go back to sleep. So I showed her this device and I showed her how it worked. And she goes, wait a minute. And she goes running off to her brother's room. And she comes running back with a couple of plastic action figures of like a Dracula and a Frankenstein or something and puts them right near it. She goes, okay, do it again. And I'm like, oh no. So she presses the button. The thing goes through its scan routine. And when it gets done, it says, no monsters detected, right? And so she's looking up at me and I said, gotcha. I said, honey, that thing is so smart it can tell that those are plastic. So you can't fool it. You can't fool it. It's only going to go off with real monsters.
Well, that was going to be my next question, is what does it do when the scan actually finds a monster?
You know, many times, and then you guys have heard this, just about every tech person that I deal with says, well, now, are you going to set up a random number generator so like one out of every eight times it's going to go, oh, God, run, there's monsters! It's like, no, it's supposed to reassure my daughter, not scare her to death.
Jumps out of the story.
Yeah, no kidding. It's like, no, it does not. It has not been able to detect any monsters as of yet. I've never seen a positive indication. Let's put it that way.
So we don't know yet.
We don't know.
That's it. So, well, can we hear it?
Well, I'll go ahead and start it running here. Let's see. I'm going to start it running by pressing the button now.
Monster detector active. Scanning. No monster detected. Scanning again.
That's great. It's the redundancy of the scan, I think, that's particularly reassuring.
We always scan twice to make sure. Now, the other thing you'll notice about the unit is right now the lights are still on, and what it does is it'll go for the next 5 minutes. Those lights will slowly fade out over a five-minute window until it goes back to being dark again. So that keeps her from triggering it multiple times and using it like a sampler with a mom, a monster. You know, it's like, no, it's not a toy. It's supposed to be used to reassure her, so it can only be triggered once every 5 minutes. But during that time, the lights just slowly fade back down again so that she has that reassurance, but it doesn't, you know, blind the whole room. And it goes back to sleep. There, it's back to sleep now.
Oh, that is fantastic. I might have to build one of those for my own daughter. She's about a year and a half.
Well, now.
You don't have monsters in your house.
No monsters.
So, and I have one last thing to say.
Oh, yeah.
If anyone wants to attend Maker Faire, tickets are available online. And also the Austin Children's Museum is selling them right up until the event. So a great way to take the family out, go to the Children's Museum and pick up your tickets, too.
It's going
to
be a blast.
And a few last-minute things. If you want to enter Maker Faire, you could build a catapult and enter the catapult contest.
By the time the episode airs, I suspect it'll be too late. Or is it not too late?
I mean, it's pretty easy to build a catapult. You bring it to the fair and shoot it off
in
the
flexible
catapult contest.
Oh, okay. Great.
We also have power tool drag races, which you could build one of those and send it down the track and see if you can do that. There's some information there. Oh, actually, the catapult contest is run by Bill Gerstel, who's the author of The Art of the Catapult and author of Backyard Ballistics. He'll also be speaking at the fair. And we have another prominent speaker is Cy Liebergott, who was in mission control during Apollo 13, and he'll be telling
kind of a
very good maker story about how they figured out how to save this spacecraft and how to, you know, check the voltage levels and all that kind of stuff to bring them back home and safely.
That's fantastic.
This is a family fun event, so it's something that the whole family can enjoy, which is pretty rare these days.
You'll be blown away.
Bring out the kids. Give them a head start in the area of doing it themselves. Thank you so much for being here. I've been here with folks from the Maker Faire coming up October 20th and 21st at the Travis County Expo Center. We've had Dale Doherty here, founder and editor of Make Magazine, Cherry Huss, director of the fair, and Vern from the Austin Robots Group. And if you're an Austin person and you're interested in robotics and these kinds of projects, then you can go to their website, which is robotgroup.org. Is that right?
That's right.
Well, thanks again, and I'm very much looking forward to the fair and seeing everybody out there.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.